Welcome to the Women's Wellness Psychiatry Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Anna Glazer, MD, a reproductive and integrative psychiatrist here to help you make sense of the complex world of women's mental health. If your goal is to improve your emotional well-being, find fulfillment, and feel like your best self, you're in the right place. Welcome, my listener friends. Thank you for joining me for this episode. As always, if you're enjoying this content, I would ask you to please just take a quick moment right now to leave a rating or review and share this content with a friend, colleague, or anyone else who you think would benefit. In this episode, I have a candid interview with Kelly Coleman, who is the author of Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child, Your Guide to the Essential Systems, Services, and Supports, which was released earlier this month. Kelly is the mom of two amazing boys, one of whom has multiple disabilities, including cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and an as-yet undiagnosed genetic condition. We know that one in 33 babies in the U.S. is born with a disability, and parents are often left struggling to figure out services, the medical system, and find support. In this book, Kelly provides parents with a very precious resource, Time Back, by presenting templates, advice, and wisdom from her own experience and those of dozens of experts. In our conversation, Kelly shares candidly about her experience with a sense of humor and ease, including the mental health impacts of parenting a child with disabilities and the importance of taking time for one's own well-being. You can learn more about Kelly and her book at kellycoleman.com/books, and that link is available for you on the show notes. Welcome, Kelly. Thank you so much for joining me today on this podcast episode.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be contributing to your community and all of this. Let's actually get real information to the people. And I'm just loving your universe of things.
Thank you so much. And I'm excited about your book. Definitely want to hear a lot more about it. Let's go into the background, though. Maybe you could share with listeners a bit about kind of your background, your family, and really what pushed you to write this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book, Everything No One Tells You About Parenting a Disabled Child, it is the book that I swore I would never write because I was like, oh, that's way too boring to dig into how to do all the paperwork and the planning and everything. And then as my journey evolved, it became the thing that I felt very compelled to write. Prior to having kids, my career was coming up with ideas for talking animal movies, which is super fun, but also means I have no real world skills. So there's that. And I have two amazing kiddos. I have a 12-year-old. I have a 10-year-old. They're both unique and wonderful and are the best of friends and are these hilarious humans. Our 10-year-old has multiple disabilities, and that is definitely not the path of parenting that we expected, but also the thing that we've had to pivot sometimes all day long to figure out exactly what that looks like for us as a family, as well as for him as an individual. And he has a yet undiagnosed genetic syndrome. And within that, his subdiagnoses include autism, epilepsy, cerebral palsy, cortical vision impairment, microcephaly, feeding tube, sensory processing, gross motor, fine motor, cognitive, behavioral, medical. I'm just going to check all the boxes. So he's an overachiever and he is just in love with life. And this is just his world and we are all living in it. And coming from the background of creative writing and figuring out what is the next thing I'm going to be working on, kept being thrown back into, I am a caregiver. I will be his caregiver as a full-time job for the rest of my life. And looking at how we are creating and putting into place systems for doing all the awful paperwork and the red tape and the systems of supporting our kids and just putting all of that stuff into place. Our last decade has been this huge learning curve of we didn't see this coming and this is the new path. And so what the heck do we do now? And fortunately, we are at a point where it's a lot of following our son's lead, which is a lot of what all parenting is.
Thank you for sharing that. Can you share with us just a little bit more about maybe how it developed for you, just looking at it from the perspective of a parent? How did you get some of these very complicated diagnoses and what that journey was like and what the time frame of that journey was like? Was this something that you realized during the pregnancy or maybe immediately postpartum, or was it down the line? And what was that experience like for you from an emotion? We talk a lot about the psychology, the emotional experience on this podcast. What was that like for you?
Yes, I'm so excited for this to be like a therapy session for me. So yes, let's dive into that. I'm a big fan of therapy. If you're listening, get therapy. It's awesome.
Absolutely.
For us, as I mentioned, this was very unexpected. Our kids are about 19 months apart. So my pregnancies were pretty much identical. And we did all of the prenatal testing and we just wanted a full awareness of everything. And nothing ever came up in testing. When there is a genetic syndrome, can't be diagnosed by any tests. It certainly isn't going to show up prenatally. And so we had no suspicion that anything was out of the ordinary with our son's development. When he was born, he was passing all of the newborn screening tests. From day one, there was that intuition in my head just saying something's going on. And anytime I would voice that to the nurses who were all lovely or to the doctors who were wonderful, everybody would say, oh, you're just hormonal. Have some ice chips. You'll be fine. First of all, I don't like ice chips. So there's that. And a second of all, it's just that voice in my head. And I think of the many things that are very universal in our journey, whether or not your listeners have a kid who is disabled, is just what is that intuition that is telling you you need to pursue something, you need to look into something, and you need to keep pursuing this. And as parents, we are the experts on our children. And we rely, and our life is a case study in relying on a team of educators, medical professionals, social workers, all the things who are experts in their fields and putting that together. I knew something was going on and we started to put the pieces together very early. Our son's first specialist appointment was when he was about 2.5 months old, and it was a neuro-ophthalmologist, means brain plus eyes. And an exam showed that physically all of the structures were there, but that his brain was not processing visual information. So he was blind. His eyes were not responding when we were shining bright lights into them. He wasn't fussing. He wasn't blinking. And we have had a really interesting journey with the vision impairment because it is a brain processing issue. We have actually, and this is very unusual, I don't want to give anyone any false promises, his very unusual journey is that he now has a tremendous amount of functional vision. And over the last decade, as his brain has developed, we have literally watched our son's vision develop and go from, yeah, he's not looking at anything ever, to being able to see a toy or something across the room that he wants, point to the toy and go and get it. So while his communication is still emerging and he can't fully communicate how his vision is developed, we see him using it. And soon after that, he was hospitalized for a week for failure to thrive, which can be such a nebulous and sometimes not entirely helpful, I'll say diagnosis. Would you call failure to thrive?
It's technically a diagnostic category, but it's very vague.
It is vague. And there's been much on our journey that has been vague. So for us, the failure to thrive category, I like that as a category, looked like he was eating next to nothing. As an infant, he was sleeping almost constantly. And the unhelpful wisdom we got was, isn't that wonderful? Your baby is sleeping so much. And I'm like, this is not okay. Like, I'm having to wake him up to eat. And I know it can be challenging for some babies to eat. That is a very real thing. It can be 100 different things. But again, that intuition of what's going on. And so really, the Odyssey started with the vision impairment diagnosis. And then really just, we started flying down the hill when we got hospitalized and started with the feeding tube and the genetic testing. And at this point, we've done literally every test science has available, and we haven't found anything. And collecting these diagnoses over the years, however you are imagining it feels, that's how it feels, which is really hard and really overwhelming. In the beginning, because no one had ever talked about anything related to disability in any of the parenting books or classes or conversations, what that feels like is it feels, oh my gosh, this is so terrible that nobody's even talking about this. It must be really bad. And I had pretty much no knowledge of disability. Certainly no knowledge of disability from actual disabled people. And it just felt like we are falling into this pit. It is a bottomless pit. And this must be the worst thing ever. Because we had no basis of knowledge for anything. And the statistics are there that disability is quite common. And because there are just not high-level conversations happening anywhere about what disability actually looks like, it was so hard and so isolating in the beginning. And it wasn't until recently somebody said a word that I'm like, that's it. That is how I felt, which is inadequate. I feel like I'm ready to cry now just thinking about this. I felt like I have no idea how to do any of this because I didn't. Right. And all anybody was telling me was, I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh, that's so terrible. I don't know how you're going to do this. I'm like, holding this baby. I'm like, can you just tell me my baby has amazing hair? That's all I want to hear right now. If somebody had just said, what information do you need? What support do you need? I don't know what to say, but I'm here for you. Would have been such a game changer. But instead, everybody is so busy reminding you how tragic your child is that, of course, it's hard because I love this baby. I don't know what I'm doing, but wow, everybody's telling me I can't do this. So I guess I can't. And it's horrible.
Yeah. And there's some really important aspects that you just mentioned. The first one that you talked about, though, was the advocacy, the needing to advocate for yourself and your baby and to even get the teams around you to pay attention. I think that's something that comes up for a lot of certainly parents and then also for folks who are advocating for themselves. And the point that you made a couple of times is in the intuition, right? I know that there's something wrong. I don't know what it is. I need your help to find out what it is, but I know that there's something wrong. And continuing to not let that go, I think, is a really important piece of that story. And then the other really valuable piece of what you said is the kind of support that would be most helpful is holding space and offering support, even if you don't know how to do, offering that support and holding that space so that it's not always, oh, what a tragedy. It's, I'm here for you. And then you can help figure out what the next steps are going to be and what kind of support to really begin to gather. Did you feel like you were reinventing the wheel a little bit because you had to start from scratch in terms of gathering all the support?
Yes, that is exactly the phrase I use. And then I realized after I finally did connect with other families on this journey, we're literally reinventing the exact same wheels to find the support, to access the services, to even know what questions to ask a specialist, because it's so new to all of us. And something that was so important on that journey and the support that we had is we had a pediatrician who's just wonderful. She's the best. And in the beginning, I kept bringing my baby into the office. And we were there a lot. And I kept saying, I have this feeling and something's going on. And one of the most important pieces that kept me going and kept my mental health, frazzled as it was, somewhat in line, was she said, you come here as often as you need to. You just show up, even if you don't have an appointment. We will always see you. We will never turn you away. We will always listen. We will always take your concerns seriously. And that relationship literally, I believe, saved my son's life. You have an infant who's not eating. That's not good. Finding those people who will listen. And when you are thinking about who is the right pediatrician for your child, none of us know what challenges our children will face. We're humans. We're going to face challenges. But when you are talking to pediatricians and saying, could I come to this person in a crisis? Would they listen to me? Can I ask them questions without judgment? And can I get objective answers? And for our pediatrician, that was all a resounding yes. And then she has walked alongside us as we have been reinventing wheels for the last decade. And that's been huge.
Absolutely. That's such an important criterion for finding that support person, that medical clinician and provider. Now, there are many other parents out there who have kids with disabilities, and it's such an intense experience. You're inventing and reinventing this wheel that we were just talking about. And yet you also then made the time to write this book, which really suggests certainly a strong passion. How did that come about?
As I mentioned, this is the book. I said I'd never write this. And everybody's, oh, you should write a book. No, that's boring. But it turns out empowering people with information is boring. My background is in writing and creative writing. So getting back into that, and this happened to be the form that it would take. When people say, how did you write a book? My answer is very slowly. I am a parent caregiver full-time and forever. So I need to always prioritize my child, and his needs are extensive. And for me, it looked like I am passionate about sharing this information, connecting with others, and just sectioning off time when the kids are at school, when he's at therapy appointments, and really being passionate about how can we all get equal access to real information that we can use to build our own journeys. And at the same time, when other parents are like, oh, you've arrived, you've figured this out, as I'm like cleaning vomit out of my hair and I've been awake all night, like stopping seizures, that I'm like, nope, haven't figured anything out. So I'm thrilled about this book. I'm so proud of it. And also, there is no destination that you reach where you're like, done, I got it all figured out. You just get better at all of the stuff and you follow your child's lead. And when you hit a point, when you realize you need to do a thing for yourself and your own mental health, for me, that looked like writing a book. For a friend, it looked like diving into her cross-stitching business on Etsy, which she hadn't touched in years and is now cross-stitching pretty cool, funny things. Who knew? It can look so different for everyone, but whatever that thing is that makes you feel like yourself and the version of you that you want to be. It can be a book. It can be something else entirely. It took me years to get to the point when I even wanted to do something for myself because I was so caught up in all of this. And now that I've done it, it feels good to feel like I am a person in addition to simply being a caregiver. Simply, yeah. Like it's simple. Yeah.
But really just emphasizing your multiple identity hats that you wear and supporting those other identity hats.
Yes, absolutely. And when we are really viewing all of the fullness of all the pieces of our identity, so many of us need to acknowledge that caregiving is a job so that we can be objective about the things that are easy and hard and what needs to be done. And also clock in and clock out when we need to. I'm never going to clock out of being a parent because that's great. Cool. But all of the stuff, I'm able to actually get objective about so that I can say I've done enough today on the caregiving piece in terms of I placed the diaper order and I checked the seizure meds and I opened up the new box of feeding tubes. I did all of that stuff. And now I'm focused on being a parent and we're just going to go to the park. And boy, that looks different for us than other families, but cool. And to be able to really honor all the parts of that, I am not disabled myself. And so I am not weirdly owning my child's disabled identity and all of the complexity of that. But I'm also not erasing who I am as a person and a caregiver whose life is given a tremendous amount of structure through my son's disability. It's messy.
Yeah. And you're diving into this conversation part that I really wanted to go into, being a psychiatrist and a podcast that really focuses on the emotional and mental health, which is how this kind of impacted your emotional and psychological well-being and what you might tell other parents about how to promote their own wellness while caring for a disabled child. And one of the things that you really strongly advised is to recognize those identity hats and to recognize the job of being a caregiver and to be able to compartmentalize that a little bit so that you can't do the same job 24/7. And I think this really hits on a theme that I talk with so many of my moms about, which is this idea of mom guilt and am I doing enough and am I being enough? And you, I think at one point, used the word inadequate
to
describe how you were feeling initially. Yep. Dive into that for us a little bit.
All of this is so messy, partly because it is constant. And when we think about mom guilt, I can on one hand say, oh, I don't feel guilty because I did all the things. But we can also be so entrenched in all of the caregiving and the stuff, especially when our children's needs are urgent and constant and medical and they need me to survive in the next hour and to do the feeding tube that he can't do himself. And there's a lot of stuff. And one of the most important pieces that I wish I had figured out earlier, because I just made my life so much harder in so many ways, is to connect with other families who are going through this. It can be very hard for all of us to be objective about our own experience and about our own mental health. I can see in friends who are going through life as a parent caregiver, when they are burnt out, overwhelmed, physically and mentally exhausted, I can spot depression in a friend in a way that I cannot spot it in myself. And that is really important because I am a very high functioning person. And by that, you give me a to-do list and I will check the things off that to-do list and I will pat myself on the back because I did the things. And so many of us in the caregiving role are very productive, are checking the things off the list. And also, we don't really have a choice but to be doing all of these things. And the workload is constant. I recently learned the term cognitive labor. And I'm like, yes, that is it. I am always thinking and my brain is always going. Because my brain is always going with the lists and the things and the checklists, because that is what we need. And that is not optional. And it is not putting myself last. That's just Tuesday. It is hard for me to step back and really objectively look out like, for real, because my answer is often, I'm great. Look at the to-do list. It is checked off, which is necessary. And it's not as easy as, oh, you should take a yoga class. Wouldn't that be nice if I was there? But for years, I didn't even want to do anything other than check things off the list, because you go into that automatic, you wake up, you do the things, and then you do them over and over every day for years. Connecting with other people in this situation allows you to look out for one another in a way that you will not always be able to look out for yourself. And that's okay. And it is doable as long as you have other people who are checking in with you and who you can trust to say, hey, I see XYZ is happening and I'm concerned about these things. If someone who is not a parent caregiver of a disabled child is telling me that, it feels very different. And it is very easy for me to quickly jump in and defend all the things exactly as they're happening. And nobody can argue with it because it's true. And they're like, oh, good for you. Keep checking things off the list. And mental health is somewhere on like page 32 of the many lists. We need the people who can remind us that keeping our mental health stable is a big key in making this journey sustainable over years and in serving our children and ourselves and our families.
And how do you personally do that? Or how do you see other friends or other members of your system doing that for themselves? Because like you said, it's not just, oh, then I'll stop doing this activity because it no longer fits on my plate. Or I'm just going to start going to yoga on Tuesdays. That's not really one yoga class isn't necessarily going to improve your entire mental health experience.
Amazing though. If you can find that class, you tell me and I will go wherever it takes. I'll take that yoga class.
Yeah.
So it's all in little bits. Everything is. And as with all the things, like there is not one destination. And for me, it's about setting up systems. So I have the first week in January, or actually the second week, because that's when the kids are back in school. I have reminders of here are the emails I need to send to put the school stuff in place, to put the social services in place, to schedule the meetings, to get these evaluations. I have reminders on my calendar. I save a copy of the paperwork I filled out last year so that I can just copy and paste it into the paperwork for this year. But how I put systems in place to anticipate things allows me to have the mental space to say, you know what? I'm going to go for a walk with the dog after I drop the kids off at school. We're going to walk for an hour. I am not going to feel guilty. I am not going to feel like I should be doing something else because I've put these things in place so that I can create this space for myself. And knowing that those days when all of the stuff is so overwhelming, then it's okay to not take an hour-long walk with the dog. And it's okay to go back to the to-do list and to say, what are some easy things I can check off because I'm feeling anxiety about all the things? And that lowers the anxiety so that I actually can be objective about how I'm doing. So I can actually have a conversation and a date night with my husband and feel good about things that make me feel good. Rather than saying there's always something to be done, so I can't ever be a person. Notice when you are feeling anxious, know what you need to feel less anxious and do the things. Sometimes it's a yoga class. Sometimes it's the to-do list, and that's okay.
Absolutely. And I think you're talking a lot about creating structure and routine to decrease the overwhelm. You're talking a lot about small steps, right? Not giant gestures, but small everyday steps that you incorporate into that routine that can really help. You mentioned time with your spouse, right? So really nourishing all of the different relationships in your life and getting support and asking for help. Asking for help can be really hard to do, but asking for help and getting those support systems in place. What support systems are out there for parents of disabled kids? And are there others that maybe you wish were out there that aren't, that could be created?
Mm-hmm. Oh, there are lots of things I wish were there. So the one thing that I wish all parents knew from the beginning, every state has a parent training and information center. and many states have multiple centers. The what is available in terms of social services, in terms of schools, in terms of your Department of Developmental Services varies wildly from state to state, and how you access things varies wildly from state to state. Who is eligible? What's available? If there are wait lists, just how much paperwork there is, it's going to be a lot wherever you are, but it'll vary. And connecting with parent training and information centers is such a great start because they can give you information that is unique and specific to your area. There's a Home and Community-Based Services Access Act that is in Congress right now. We need to tell them to pass this. And that is what gives the social service support that we need to sustain our kids' livelihoods even outside of a hospital setting. There are families who are not able to leave a hospital with their child because everything is covered once you're inpatient. And then as soon as you're outpatient, it's not covered anymore. But if we can connect with our local fellow parents, our local social service agencies, our local schools, if we can start by just finding out what is available and where to start, how to ask the right questions. I'm in California. I didn't want to write a book that was specific to California because that's useless for most people. I wanted to write something that is about how do you find out the things and ask the right questions to build your own journey. And a big part of that for us has been following our son's lead. The feeding therapy where he would just throw up and cry and tantrum. We're like, oh, maybe we should discontinue this because this is horrible for all of us, especially him, versus the therapy where it was play-based and we're playing kickball as a family in the yard and facilitating his communication, which he loves and wants more of, through a kickball game. Oh, let's keep this going. And really following his lead has been a big driver in how we put our journey together.
What else would you like parents to know? Or what would you like clinicians who work with parents and their kids to know?
For parents, the biggest thing is so many of us on the beginning of this journey feel exactly the same way. It's that bottomless pit. This is awful and it's never going to get better. And what am I even doing? That's not how I feel now. But boy, that's how I felt for a long time because I felt like that feeling was forever. At the beginning, I wish someone had validated how I was feeling rather than telling me to cheer up. I wish someone had said,
if that works.
Right. Have you ever been in an interaction where somebody's been like, you need to buck up and have a different mindset about this really hard thing? And you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't think of that. You're right. I need to feel better about epilepsy. Oh, now I do. Thanks. Oh. However you feel, just know that you will feel better. This feeling is not forever. And the thing that bridges how you're feeling now to how you will feel better and eventually, I'm going to cry, is just falling in love with your kid and who they are as a person. And we all know our paths diverge and take all the directions and all the unexpected ways. And there's a lot that is hard. What's not hard is just loving my kid and just leaning into that and to who they show you that they are. We spend a lot of time cheering for the lettuce at the grocery store because my son really likes the lighting situation by the lettuce. That is not how I expected to spend my Sunday afternoon with my 10-year-old. But you know what? We lean into it and it actually is a lot of fun and it does have a good lighting situation. And for clinicians to really build the relationship with families by being a partner they can trust, by the basics, which you know, of listening to and learning from the parents about their child, but most importantly, not being the clinician who says, oh my gosh, this is just terrible news I have to give you. Oh, you came to me and your child is disabled. Oh my gosh, I can't imagine. Gotta stop that. And so many of us parents have that story of walking into an office and hearing how terrible this is, rather than clinicians saying, this is information about your child. Let's work together to use that information to best serve your child. It makes our lives easier as parents. It also makes your job easier as a clinician to say, let's use the information to serve your child. We're doing this together. Because the parent will let down their guard, will trust you, listen to you. And if a doctor is not approaching this from a we're a team place, parents will very often come in from a place of defensiveness and declaring, here's what we need to do and here's what this is. And I know I want this appointment to go. And as a clinician, you've been trained in this for a very long time and you have a tremendous amount of expertise. And if you can set the stage so that the parent is ready to hear your expertise, even if it is not what they most want to hear, which it often isn't, then you're really setting things up for success for everyone and especially for the child.
Yeah, it sounds really having that team approach, right? Where it's working together, the clinician and the parent in the service of the child.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And also for clinicians, parents just feel lost when we are just making all this up as we are going along. If you can parents like to have a job because sometimes when we're overwhelmed, give us a list of things to check off and then we can feel like we did something. Remind parents to write things down, to write down their observations, take a video of the behavior that they are seeing that they are concerned about. Write down that list of questions, bring those in. If you are reminding parents to come in prepared, they will feel good about being prepared and they won't feel anxious about the limited time they have with you. And they won't be describing an episode. They will be showing you a video and you can decide, oh, we should refer you to neurology. We should refer you to a developmental pediatrician. We should keep an eye on this. Come back in next week. And when clinicians are able to give families that job and that feedback, it really makes the process so much smoother.
Absolutely. It really sounds empowering the parent to do the things that they will be doing with their child and for their child so that it really helps remove what I imagine is a feeling that comes up periodically is that sense of helplessness. Like, how do I help my child? Mm-hmm. And this is a really concrete way that someone can help their child.
Yeah.
In the medical setting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that will come up often and perhaps forever. And when new things pop up, good and bad, especially for kids like mine, when there isn't diagnosis, so there's no roadmap, we're just winging it. It's just good to get feedback and to get a list of here's what you can do to help your child. It feels great.
Yeah. And you've helped people, parents, stop reinventing the wheel by publishing this book, which is a published wheel, so to speak.
Yes.
Going with that metaphor. So where can parents find and purchase your book?
Yes. So my book recently came out. It's available at all the book places, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, your local bookseller. And it really is the guidebook that I wish I had had a decade ago when we started on this journey. I tell parents it's the alternative to go home, Google, and cry, which is basically what most of us are told when we get a diagnosis. And if we can just start with a foundation of real information about disability on the whole, about what is available and how to navigate all the complexities, we can better serve our children and ourselves. And we can, at some point, hopefully soon, get back to just being parents who love our kids.
Yeah. And really being in those moments of joy that you described in front of the lettuce.
You know what? We got some good lettuce.
I love that. I love that. Any final pearls of wisdom to share with our audience, our listeners?
My final thought is, if you are in this world and you are feeling overwhelmed by all the stuff, yes, you're right on schedule. That is a thing, and you are not alone in that feeling. When you feel like you are ready to tackle the mountain of stuff, choose one thing. Make it an easy thing where you can see a victory. Maybe that is asking your child's school if they have speech therapy at the school. The answer is yes, they do. Whether it is asking one question, whether it is emailing a parent who you've heard from the school system has a kid similar to yours, where you feel like you can have a victory, because amassing all of those little victories is what makes tackling that mountain possible. You are not going to tackle that mountain today. You might wake up feeling just as overwhelmed tomorrow, but then you'll remember that one thing you did and know that you can keep climbing that mountain until it starts to shrink.
I love it. One thing at a time.
Yes.
One step at a time. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining me for this week's podcast episode. I really appreciate it. And it was such a wonderful conversation.
Yes. Thank you for having me. I love all that you are doing.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me for this week's episode. As you know, my goal is to share with you the most helpful information that moves you towards emotional well-being. If you have suggestions or questions, I'd love to hear those. And I also always appreciate a rating that will help others find this valuable content. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again next week. Please note that while I am a clinical doctor, this podcast is not a substitute for, nor should be taken as, medical advice. No specific health advice is being given on this podcast, and no physician-client relationship is created by you listening to this podcast. All information provided on this podcast is for informational purposes.